Thank you, folks. Have a seat. And good morning. Give us just a moment to get set up. So we're here for our second oral argument of the morning in case number one, CASA 260176, State v. Aguirre. The proceedings are being video and audio taped. They're also being broadcast across the internet, live stream. So we do ask that when you approach the podium, please state your name and identify the party that you represent so that the folks, wherever they may be watching or observing the argument, know who you're speaking for. Each side does have 20 minutes. You don't need to use all of them. We have, as we'll, I'll explain, we are very familiar with the case, so focus your arguments. Appellate's counsel is responsible for reserving any time for rebuttal. Please feel free to tell us if that's what you want to do, but it's your responsibility to maintain it. We may give you a heads up if we see you encroaching, but it's yours to guard. We have read the briefs. We have conferenced the case. We're very familiar with the record. So we'd ask that you focus your argument. And with that, counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court, I'm Jennifer Rethemeyer for the state. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Courts read statutes together whenever possible. The phrase, notwithstanding any other law, doesn't change this principle. Instead, it tells a court which law applies in the event of a conflict. Neither the Superior Court nor Mr. Aguirre has identified any conflict between the statutes at issue here. In fact, this court has read the notice of claim statute together with a law that included a notwithstanding provision in the Boyd matter. If our legislature had intended the notwithstanding provision to preempt the notice of claim law, it would have done so. Mississippi, for example, includes the following language in its erroneous conviction statute. Notwithstanding any other provision of law, failure to file any applicable notice of claim shall not bar filing of a claim under this chapter. Our legislature took a different approach. The Superior Court labeled erroneous conviction claims as a self-contained system and concluded that the notice of claim statute didn't apply as a result. This is incorrect legally and factually. Legally, neither the Superior Court nor Mr. Aguirre provided any authority for the notion that a notice of claim statute wouldn't apply to a self-contained system. Instead, where a self-contained system wouldn't require a notice of claim, that would be for the reason that there's a conflict in the provisions, that it had some other way of requiring that a claim be filed. And we just don't have that kind of a conflict here. Factually, I'd like to explain that this is not a self-contained system at all. This is an action filed in Superior Court. And we know exactly how these have proceeded because we have been litigating them for the last 6 months. These involve scheduling orders, discovery, dispositive motions, and even the prospect of experts in some of these matters. So this is not a self-contained system, you know, wholly apart from the court system, the way that the Superior Court may have envisioned it.
But it is a self-contained system in the sense that you have a statute of limitations that is different from that which normally applies to claims against the state, correct?
Correct.
And you have the service on the Attorney General, and the Attorney General directed to respond within 30 days, which is different than the rules of civil procedure would provide, correct?
That's correct.
So, okay. And so that gets me to my next question, which is notwithstanding any other law an ambiguous term?
I don't think so. I think specifically what it does here is that it speaks to the fact that this is a new claim that the legislature was creating. So what follows the notwithstanding provision is the elements of the claim. And so, you know, if you contrast this with something like some of the other claims that a person could bring having been wrongfully convicted. So take a malicious prosecution claim. There, normally a claimant would need to prove the absence of probable cause. Well, that's a problem when you have a conviction because that carries with it a finding of probable cause. So what the notwithstanding provision does here is it preempts these other elements of law that, you know, we might otherwise try to say apply. We can't argue that a claimant here needs to prove the absence of probable cause because this notwithstanding provision clears the field for the elements that the legislature wanted.
So if you just agree that notwithstanding any other law is unambiguous, I suppose. I think then we would look to the Glen Eyre case for the definition of that, from the Supreme Court for the definition of that. Is that right? Is that the best case for us to look to?
Well, it comes from the Supreme Court, yes. There are other applications of it that help guide a court in terms of how to apply it. But yes, we don't dispute that Glen Eyre is good law.
Okay. So Glen Eyre says that notwithstanding is means without prevention or obstruction from or by, and that any means one or some indiscriminately of whatever kind. So I'm just trying to square that with how you appear to be narrowly reading notwithstanding any other law to apply to sort of the underlying elements of the criminal offense that you're looking at there, or the substantive law versus what we might view as a more procedural requirement as filing a notice of claim. When I have these very broad terms from Glen Eyre as to the definition of notwithstanding any other law.
And so in Glen Eyre, they found a direct conflict there, that there was an inability to apply both statutes, right? Either there was a statute of repose, or the government could file when it wanted, right? There was no way to reconcile those two things, and that's why the notwithstanding provision came into effect there. Here, this doesn't prevent a person from bringing their claim, right? And that goes to the fact that, you know, below, our motion to dismiss wasn't seeking a dismissal with prejudice. It was seeking a dismissal without prejudice. Mr. Aguirre can bring his claim following the filing of a notice of claim.
Did Glen Eyre say, though, that it was that definition, that very broad definition of notwithstanding any other law, only applies? I think the state uses the term this sort of irreconcilability standard. I think that's what you use in your briefs. Did Glen Eyre say that broad definition only applies in the context of two statutes that are irreconcilable?
So it does have the language about where there are potentially conflicting laws. That language is in Glen Eyre.
Okay.
And I think that, you know, as this court has applied it in Boyd, you are looking for a conflict, because the first principle that you start from here is just going back to statutory interpretation, where when you can read the statutes together, the court does.
But in looking at Boyd and even, I believe, Glen Eyre, the issues there were statute of limitation issues, which means you could absolutely read them together, because all you're looking at is how long it takes before you can file a claim. In this statute that's at issue here, it's a whole procedure that the legislature set up. So is Boyd really even instructive here, notwithstanding, is it really instructive as to how we should look at 1342-96? Because it was in those cases were interpreting how the notice of claim statutes fits within a statute of limitations limitation versus a brand new procedure that is being set up for filing claims.
So it does, and that's because it shows that the filing of a notice of claim can be a procedure that you still follow, even if there are other rules that can apply. And as to the second portion of the question, that this is a different system, this is an action filed in Superior Court. And I think it's helpful here to look at the context of how these statutes operate nationwide. Many states have erroneous conviction statutes. They take a wide variety of approaches to how they do that. Many use administrative proceedings. You know, Maryland and Georgia send it through an ALJ. California uses a victim's compensation board. So there are ways to do this that would be separate and apart and potentially fall within, you know, a characterization as a self-contained system. That's not what Arizona did. Arizona created an action filed in Superior Court that has, in practice, much followed the same procedures that we use in, you know, the cases that I've litigated for 15 years.
And so if we're looking at it from your perspective, the legislative findings in the bill that adopted this statute talk about obstacles. If the notice of claim statute isn't one of those obstacles, what obstacles would the legislature be referring to?
So this is a procedure that requires its own set of elements, right, that are presumably, in the legislature's eyes, you know, easier to prove. It's addressed through an evidentiary proceeding instead of a jury trial, and there are some different deadlines that apply. So it's that's how, you know, the legislature has chosen to approach it here, despite other alternatives.
But I don't feel like you're answering my question as to what obstacles specifically. You alluded to some, but what obstacles do you think the legislature was referring to in its finding statement in the legislation, the bill adopting this law, that said it wanted to sort of lift some of the obstacles that prevent people from obtaining compensation?
I think that, you know, by making it a different type of claim, that's the main way in which it was doing so. The legislature knew about the notice of claim statute when it passed the erroneous conviction statute. The Boyd case was already on the books at that point in time as well. So it was against that backdrop that the legislature passed this law without referencing the notice of claim statute.
But if they knew the notice of claim statute was there and they still used notwithstanding, shouldn't we consider that?
So I don't think so, and it's because the notwithstanding provision has to be read in conjunction with what follows. So it's notwithstanding any other law, a claimant may file an action seeking compensation from the state if they prove certain elements. And here, claimants can do so. And if they have.
I'm trying to figure out, too, under this statute. The statute makes the, and you keep talking about this is an action in superior court. It's a little bit different than a normal action against a public entity. If, you know, I tripped and fell at a state building, I want to sue the state, I could sue the state of Arizona, I'd file a notice of claim with the state. These actions are different because the pleadings are entitled under 1342.96b in the matter of the erroneous conviction of, insert the name of the claimant there. Who would the notice of claim be filed against?
Against the state. So the naming convention that you referenced, I think, is part of a bigger theme within the statute of clearing a convicted person's name. So you see this throughout in terms of, you know, allowing for expungement of the conviction and sealing of records and an inability to use the conviction in the future. That all goes to clearing a person's name. And, you know, consider a convicted person who is later applying for a job, and the employer Googles this person. And they see yet another action that's, you know, state versus or in the reverse, you know, that employer thinks either, well, okay, so there's a lot going on criminally, or this person is litigious, you know, neither of which are going to get the person hired. By labeling this in re the erroneous conviction of, it goes to this goal of clearing the person's name. I also don't think that the naming convention holds all that much weight when there are all manner of different naming conventions used. For court cases, you know, for example, once class cert has been granted, you know, a class action will be called in re the defendant's name. That doesn't mean that there's no plaintiff at issue. And
right,
so I think
but there's a named defendant is my point. And I guess my next question, going to the context of the statute, which is something that we were supposed to look to in interpreting the plain language of a statute. If you look further down in subsection E of the statute, it allows the court to make findings if the attorney general requests it, essentially allocating fault as between county and local officials for that. So if I'm a claimant and I think I was wrongfully convicted and I say, well, my claim's against the state, but actually it was the Pinal County attorney's fault, would I also need to name the Pinal County attorney's office? Would I need to name the line lawyer who I think was responsible for my conviction? Would I need to name the police officer who I think planted evidence that led to my wrongful conviction? I mean, this is more to the point about this being just its own system, and that notwithstanding any other law, might be doing a lot more work than the state giving it credit for.
Well, so I think that there, things are a little more intertwined than it may seem. Our office has supervisory authority over county prosecutors. So I do think that there's an element of blame involved, and that is why, you know, this is not an ex parte proceeding. This is an adversarial proceeding. And that's why there's necessarily a respondent involved here, you know, contrary to...
Yeah, but I think Judge Gaona makes a really important distinction here, because in a notice of claim, when you file a notice of claim, you have to file against every single party that you're potentially bringing the claim against. And so if we're to adopt your position, I think then the state potentially, if we were to adopt your position, the state potentially then could come in and say, well, you didn't file a proper notice of claim against however many parties, you know, are potentially involved, and therefore, you know, your claim should be dismissed. again, isn't that another obstacle that the legislature potentially was looking at?
So I don't think so, because of the way in which other parties are brought in here. Our office needs to request those findings of fact before the city or county prosecutor is involved. So that's why I don't see that as an obstacle.
But if they hadn't filed a notice of claim and you were successful in bringing them in, does that kill it? What if the notice of claim didn't go against the county or the city that brought the charges?
Well, because
it's now an obstacle, a very clear obstacle to being able to proceed.
So we see the state as the respondent here. And we have any number of options.
I understand your point, but under the notice of claim statute and all of the case law that talks about it, you have to name every single party you're bringing the case against. So is your position that under this statute, the notice of claim only has to be named against the state? And where in the statute does it say that? Are we just supposed to assume that? Because how is a claimant supposed to even know who to name on the notice of claim statute?
So because the state...
Or notice of claim, sorry.
Yeah. So because the state is the respondent and we're the ones who may invoke findings of fact and conclusions of law against others, you know, I don't see the city or county prosecutor as a respondent in the way that we are. So no, I don't think that there's a requirement that a notice of claim individually include, you know, each person or entity who may have been involved in the prosecution.
So let me ask you, because the Legislative Council has a bill drafting manual, and they warn against using this clause. And they say, look, if you're going to do something like this, please identify the statutes that you are specifically trying to avoid rather than this general clause. So I'm struggling with the notice of claim statute is an obstacle to people bringing suits. It is designed to be such. It forces faster action against the state than otherwise would be allowed. So I'm curious as to why, without any, you know, addressing why the notice of claim statute would still apply, the statute doesn't clear that up for us. Because it seems to me you're saying we should read it that it still applies and the legislature left it to us to sort out all sorts of problems that come if we don't find that the notice of claim statute does not apply under the notwithstanding clause.
Courts presume that other laws apply unless there is or express or implied repeal. Here, there's no express repeal. And you know, we don't see this as an implied repeal for the reason that, you know, the legislative findings of seeking to reduce hurdles, you know, that doesn't trump the actual statute, which doesn't make reference to this. And in
so
context
what was
here,
notwithstood? What did the legislature notwithstand?
Notwithstanding the elements that people are required to prove in order to usually bring
need
a similar.
It for that. They were establishing the you know, the claim. So you don't need notwithstanding language for that. They just say the claim is. So what was not withstood? It has to have some meaning. Can you tell me a single thing that was not withstood?
So I think that examples would include, you know, other things that we could try to bring into these claims. For example, the erroneous conviction statute is housed in the criminal code. Instead of, you know, normally other things would be in section 12. You know, what if we were to come in and argue that it really needs to be under a beyond a reasonable doubt standard? Because that's the standard applicable, you know, to matters under the criminal code. Well, the notwithstanding provision says, no, it's under a preponderance of the evidence standard.
But the statute says preponderance, right?
Correct.
So it didn't need to notwithstand. It made it clear. I want to know what was not withstood.
So
that's not an argument to me. If the statute says the standard is a preponderance of the evidence, I don't think you get to walk in and say, no, they meant something different. What was not withstood?
So as someone who did not draft this statute, it's hard to say exactly. It may have been simply cautionary language because of the effort to make this something new. But
and
where
could
I
have been
think
cautionary
it,
language that we didn't want to preclude the claim because of a notice of claim defect, because some of these arose a long time ago, right?
That's
and,
right.
And there, and the certainly the exception period goes far longer than the notice of claim period, right?
By
so they
exception,
are allowed to file, but under your argument, The minute the statute took place, if they had an existing claim, they had to act within the notice of claim period, not the new statute of limitations established, right?
That's correct.
So essentially, you're arguing that even though it said this, even though it established a new express statute of limitations, that they were saying on all these claims, not just some, because they're all against the state, all of them will be barred if they existed the date the statute took effect within the 180 days because of the notice of claim.
So I don't think so at all. Take, for example, a claimant who wants the non-monetary relief, right? So a notice of claim is not required where, you know, only non-monetary relief is sought. And here it's meaningful, things like an expungement, you know, of the conviction. You know, a person could bring that later in the time period. I also think that saying that there's a two-year time period here maybe overstating things a bit, given that there is a sunset provision in this law at the 18-month mark. So to say that there's, you know, I think that may be unclear.
Anyone for 180 days?
No.
No. But you would put, your reading would put one in there very plainly, right?
For older convictions.
For anything
that are seeking monetary relief, yes, we do.
Legislature knows how to do that, doesn't it? When it wants to do that.
Yes, as it would have known how to expressly preempt the notice of claim statute.
Instead, it said notwithstanding any other law.
I'd like to reserve any possible remaining time.
Well, I have more time. Yeah, no, this is
anything further.
So we'll give you an extra 5 minutes.
Because I have another question.
You go right ahead.
So I just, and I feel like we're belaboring this point, but so if we're to take your position and we incorporate, you know, the notice of claim, so we're trying to read these statutes together and someone files a notice of claim, but they can file their claim in court the same day or day after. Now that 60-day time period within the notice of claim statute is almost moot because within 30 days, the AG has to take action. And yes, you can get, you know, an extension or whatever, but I'm struggling to see your perspective as to how these work together, because I might buy your argument that if someone files a notice of claim and then takes 6 more months before they actually file the Superior Court action, okay, I might buy your argument. But nothing requires them to do that. So even if we're trying to read them together, they file the notice of claim, they file their claim the same day or day after in Superior Court, that whole notice of claim statute provision and timeline is out the window based on this statute. So how do we really read them together kind of with what your argument is based on timelines?
So any additional advance notice to us is extremely helpful in these labor-intensive cases. What we have to do when we get one of these cases in is go investigate as a threshold matter innocence, because that's an element that a claimant must prove, you know, their burden to prove that. And in many cases, this involves getting the full criminal record that may be decades old, involve considerable post-conviction proceedings. We're involved reviewing not only for that, we have to determine whether we want to seek factual findings against any of the prosecutors involved. We also need to notify victims in a lot of cases. You know, the erroneous conviction statute requires us to bring them in where they have requested post-conviction notice. And generally, Arizona, you know, provides victims' Bill of Rights and generally tries to include them in the process. This has been very difficult for us to do within the time provisions of the statute. So any additional notice that we get via the notice of claim is particularly helpful to us. It's also helpful to have...
But it's not required, is my point.
That it could be a short time. It may not be a lot of notice. I understand that. It's also helpful to have the some certain settlement demand because contrary to what the statute may appear to be, it's not so simple to calculate the damages here. You know, for example, the main portion of the damages comes from a measurement of double the median household income for each year that the person was incarcerated. The statute says that it needs to be HUD's take on those numbers. HUD does not keep those numbers. So right off the bat, we're into negotiations with folks over, you know, how we actually calculate these damages. So having that some certain settlement demand helps us to get the ball rolling.
Thank you.
Anything further? Thank you. I'll reserve remaining time. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Stephen Benedetto of the People's Law Firm. I'm here today on behalf of Respondent Enrique Aguirre. And on Mr. Aguirre's behalf, I would request that the court affirm the ruling of the Superior Court that the Notice of Claim statute does not apply to the new Erroneous Conviction Act. The court has anticipated most of my arguments. I will not retread that. Instead, I'll try to shift on the fly here a bit and just point out that if we were to gather all of the civil rights lawyers in the entire state, they probably would fit in the front row here. And the reason for that is because regular personal injury lawyers are scared to death to take cases against the state because the notice of claim is the most ubiquitous, most aggressive procedural obstacle the law creates. It comes in 180 days. It's very limited in terms of how quickly it can accrue, and claims are eliminated all the time. And so what we're talking about today isn't about really harmonization. What we're talking about is state's
they
effort.
They can be eliminated on technicalities. The number wasn't specific enough. This wasn't correct enough. So it's not just the timing. It's also the what needs to be alleged in a notice of claim, which is different than what needs to be alleged in a lawsuit under 4926 or 4296, right?
Absolutely. And it also is specific to who it's served on. Until fairly recently, when the Supreme Court decided you don't actually have to serve a notice of claim on an individual officer, a claim for vicarious liability under state law can solely be served on the entity, cases were being thrown out of Superior Court regularly, including two of my firm's own, because we did not serve officers who are notoriously difficult to serve. So this is a legal and procedural obstacle that is ripe with malpractice exposure, with concerns, and with
the counsel, I'm just going to interrupt you because I don't think we're looking at whether the notice of claim statute is good or bad or whatever. We're just looking at this notwithstanding statute. I know we've asked a lot of questions about the obstacles and stuff like that. I think that was more directed towards the state because I think there are plenty of good reasons for the notice of claim statute. I think what we're looking at is its application under this statute solely. And so I guess I want to know why you think it can't be read together as the state believes.
Well, of course, Your Honor, and it starts with the very opening of the statute, as the court is aware, notwithstanding, of course. That is the key language. We assume that the legislature knows what they are doing when they do it. And notwithstanding is used, yes, in subsection A, and it specifically precedes the words, notwithstanding any other law, a claimant may bring an action in Superior Court. Subsection C then sets a statute of limitations of 2 years with unique trigger deadlines for those accrual periods. By applying the notice of claim statute, as the court has suggested by its prior questioning, what we're doing is saying that people who were acquitted on retrial or had their convictions set aside, or had their convictions overturned prior to January 1st, 2026, got out of prison, don't have until January 1st, 2028, as the statute provides in subsection C, they only have until Tuesday. And that's, I think, what this appeal is about. We are eliminating an entire class of claims, and that's the contradiction. When the state suggests there is no contradiction between the statutes, that's the obvious contradiction. On the most basic level, the legislature is saying, notwithstanding any other law. There's a deeper level to this, too, which is 12.820. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Isn't there some textual support for what you just argued in the fact that they created a new statute of limitations within this? Because otherwise they would have also wiped out all, and well, they did, arguably, with the notwithstanding any other law, all the statute of limitations that are identified in other statutes and created their own here. And if they wanted to do that with the notice of claim, they could have done the same thing here. They could have provided or at least addressed it. So they knew when there could be this tension between the two, how to include one, and they didn't include the other. Is that fair?
I think that's fair, Your Honor. You anticipated where I was headed with this in a way. The one-year statute of limitations, as the court knows, is found in 12-821. The notice of claim requirement is 12-821.01. It modifies that one-year requirement. This statute creates a totally new, again, self-contained regulatory scheme or statutory compensation scheme with its own statute of limitations. It's in Title 13, as my friend from the other side acknowledged, not in Title 12. It is subject to this two-year statute, not the one-year statute of 12-821. So what the state is essentially asking here is this court engage in some act of judicial trailblazing to hold that a claim that is new, that has notwithstanding language in it, at the time it's drafted, that anticipates the existence of other law, which we assume the legislature is aware of, did not mean to actually hold this statute apart. And what I heard in terms of obstacles other than the notice of claim from my friend on the other side is that, you know, the state's litigating these cases. They still have scheduling orders. They still have motion practice. They still have experts, dispositive motions, it sounds like. What obstacles are we talking about that this statute was designed to eliminate on behalf of this this persecuted class of people other than the notice of claim statute, which is the most aggressive obstacle there is? I can't think of any. Ultimately, I think what we're dealing with very, very clearly is an independent, self-contained statutory compensation scheme with its own burdens of proof, its own captioning kind of standard, its own requirements for service of process, its own forum and venue selection process, and specifically Superior Court taking it out of the realm of Title 12, and it's in Title 13. It's in the criminal code. It's difficult to imagine a logical argument that says the legislature couldn't have anticipated that 12.821.01 would apply here, and therefore we must assume that their failure to address it means they wanted it to apply.
In the state's reply brief, they cite a case from this court, Huber versus Arizona Naturopathic Physicians. You haven't had a chance to address that yet since it came in the reply brief. Does that case change our analysis of notwithstanding clauses at all, or could you address how we should deal with that case in writing our decision here?
Yeah, thank you for that, Your Honor. Yes, the Huber case, as I recall, specifically references Glen Eyrie and the standard the court earlier noted. The suggestion was that this is essentially an irreconcilable conflict, but neither Glen Eyrie nor Huber speaks to that. Glen Eyrie actually talks about potential conflicts. That's the language the Supreme Court uses. So when we're talking about binding authority on this court, I think Glen Eyrie is still good law. I believe the state acknowledged that. And we're talking about potential conflicts, of which 821.01's notice of claim requirement is one. It's certainly a potential conflict. It is not the respondent's burden to show it is an irreconcilable conflict, solely that because it's a potential conflict, we have to assume that the legislature, when it drafted this language, was aware of that potential conflict. We don't have to crawl inside their minds and say they had to have been aware of it because it's irreconcilable. It's not an example like a preponderance versus a beyond a reasonable doubt type standard.
And sort of building on that a little bit, your friend on the other side talks a lot about how it's not, these statutes aren't irreconcilable because it is possible to comply with both of them, and I suppose that's true in some sense. How do you respond to that?
I think if that were the standard, again, this goes very much along with what I just argued, Your Honor. If that were the standard, that we would have to prove irreconcilability, it would take an act of legislative malpractice for this court to ever enforce a statute or ever reconcile, engage in harmonization. The legislature would have to pass two laws that are so clearly in opposition to each other and not make clear which one applies that would require a court to clarify. I think this is a situation where it's a perfect situation for application of the court's role to look at the statutes, assume the legislature did what it intended to do, and to apply the laws as it's written.
Any examples where the legislature has created a cause of action like this and not used notwithstanding language, or other examples where they created a cause of action like this and used it, anything like that? And I'm not sure there is, but I'm asking if you found anything.
We have not found anything, Your Honor. I wish there were. That would, I think, provide us the easiest avenue to say, well, here's where they've done it and here's how it applies. I can direct the court generally, which I think offers some guidance on that point, to the notice of claim statute. If we look at 821.01 subsection C,
could you say that again a little slower?
12.821.01 subsection C. That is the provision of the notice of claim statute that specifically speaks to other self-contained type schemes. It's not quite like this, because those are situations where a notice of claim could follow an administrative resolution. But this is a provision of the notice of claim statute that specifically says that in certain types of remedies that the legislature creates, the notice of claim statute does not apply, or at least it does not run until after administrative remedies are explored. But that's the closest I think we can get, and it's not totally linear, I understand that. The last point I wanted to address very briefly, I'm happy to take any other questions, of course, but is kind of the suggestion at the end of the reply brief, which obviously I've not had a chance to respond to, that if this were simply about timing and a desire of my client, Mr. Aguirre, to move this matter quickly forward, he would have just filed a notice of claim. And of course, I think it's always easier for a citizen to comply with the demands of their government than to stand up and say those demands are unlawful. That conflicts with the law. It's always going to be quicker just to do what the government says to do. The challenge here is that what the AG is saying to do is not what the legislature prescribes. And that's why Mr. Aguirre is here. He's not directly impacted by this, nearly to the level as the people who will come after him. The people who don't realize that this statute even exists, maybe, or if they do, their attorneys have slept on it and haven't initiated a lawsuit. If this court does what the state asks it to do, Tuesday will be the sunset for everybody, as the court advised. And I think for the clear legislative intent, that would be more than harmonization. It would be nullification of legislative intent, and that's not the court's role.
I know this is in the record, but I'm curious, are you handling any of, I think the state says there's 12 or 13 of these pending right now in Superior Court. Are you or your firm handling any of the other cases?
We have one case we've prepared. I don't believe we filed it.
Okay.
So we're not personally familiar with what's happening in those other cases.
I'm wondering if you can just address sort of the state's arguments about using the notice of claim to help administer this fund, because otherwise it becomes first in and, you know, potentially the first claimant uses all the funds depending on the claims, right? And then there's nothing for anyone else. Can you just address that argument a little bit?
Sure. I think irrespective of whether the Notice of Claim Act applies or not, we've got that same problem. There's only $3 million in the fund, apparently. The way you can read the law in such a way that requires the state to continually replenish that fund, but I don't know if that's happening. What I can say, as the court pointed out, whether a notice of claim is filed or not doesn't impair a plaintiff from moving forward. Excuse me, whether a notice of claim is filed does not impair a plaintiff from moving forward with the claim and waiting for the government to investigate and budget. The claimant can file the day after they file a notice of claim, and the government can still have it 60 days. So if this is a question of investigation and settlement, there's no rule that says they can't settle. If the state would like to approach us after this and say, hey, we'd like to write your client a check, that would be allowed. There's no requirement that they only do that within the notice of claim framework. So the suggestion that we need a notice of claim to somehow budget, I think, is ultimately cover for something else, which is we just got dumped all of these cases. The legislature hasn't provided additional funding for us, the AG's office, to hire more attorneys. We need more time. And if we can enforce this, we can cut off 18 months worth of claims, and we can buy ourselves hopefully an additional 60 days. But I don't see how that 60 days changes an investigatory or budgeting actual analysis, because ultimately the plaintiff can still move forward. And they still have their 60 days from the time the complaint is served until the time they have to respond, because they have 30 days plus an additional 30-day extension. So I just, for me, that argument doesn't quite land. I don't see the connection.
Thank you.
If there's no other questions, then I don't need to reserve 10 minutes, but thank you very much. I appreciate it.
So I'd like to start with the notion that the inclusion of a statute of limitations is not inconsistent with applying the notice of claim statute here. The court still has this underlying obligation to harmonize statutes when possible, and it could, frankly, do what it did in Boyd and find that although there is a notice of claim required, you don't have to do it within the 180 days. So that's, I think, the first step if the court were to find a conflict. And I don't think that there is one. But if so, that's the next step, not to simply declare that the statute is unavailable, or I should say inapplicable. It's that time provision wouldn't apply. You still have to do it. I also want to note the difference in language from Boyd. So Boyd dealt with a statute that said that a claimant may file until a certain date. We have very different language here, which is they must file within X number of 2 years of accrual. This is different language and does not imply that the person has the entirety of a 2-year time period in which to file. And I want to go also to the idea of, you know, the money running out and what happens there. Just in the last few days, Governor Hobbs signed a suite of budget provisions, and one of those modifies the statute creating the dedicated fund. It says that the state is not liable above and beyond the money that is appropriated into the fund. So, you know, it comes into play in a couple of ways. You know, one, I think it reinforces that we're the respondent here. But another, that's it for the money. You know, this suite of budget bills, there was no additional funding appropriated for this fund. So that's it. And I frankly think that it means in part that, you know, what we're dealing with here is not just the monetary compensation. It is also these other forms of relief that a person can get. And again, those are not implicated by the notice of claim statute, which only applies where there's monetary relief sought.
Are you aware in the 12 other cases, or if I have that number wrong, please correct me, were notices of claim filed in those other cases?
Yes.
Okay.
And so I'll conclude with this idea that the notwithstanding language must have gone to the notice of claim statute, because what else would it have gone to? You know, if that had been the case, the legislature would have done what Mississippi did and said, notwithstanding other law, you don't have to file a notice of claim. With that, we'll ask that the court please reverse. Thank you.
Thank you, folks. We appreciate the argument. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision in due course. With that, we'll stand adjourned.